Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 27th of June. This story caught a lot of people's attention over the weekend, and one of the people who broke the story, Bill Leaders from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Justice, along with Wisconsin Public Radio, broke this story. The Capitol Police Chief, Charles Tubbs, told WPR that he would be issuing a statement sometime today, so we're awaiting that statement. The article goes like this, in case you haven't heard it. Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice David Prosser allegedly grabbed fellow Justice Ann Walsh Bradley around the neck in an argument in her chambers last week, according to at least three knowledgeable sources. Other sources have offered a conflicting account, and Justice Prosser made this comment on Saturday. Once there's a proper review of this matter and the facts surrounding it are made clear, the anonymous claim made to the media will be proven false. Until then, I will refrain from further public comment. Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Ann Walsh Bradley issued this statement on Saturday, saying the facts are that I was demanding that he get out of my office, and he put his hands around my neck in anger in a chokehold. Those are the facts, and you can try to spin those facts and try to make it sound like I ran up to him and threw my neck into his hands, but that's only spin. Matters of abusive behavior in the workplace aren't resolved by competing press releases. The governor was on Joy Cardine's show this morning and commented on this and said that they were very serious charges, serious allegations made by each of the justices. And the court needs to be able to rationally discuss important issues, and that this exposes a much larger problem on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We're going to be talking with Bill, the first part of All Things Political, about this. Later this hour, Bill Schneider will be joining us, senior correspondent for CNN, and we'll be looking at national news. All hour, we welcome your phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you're welcome to do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Bill Leaders of the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Justice joins us the first part of our program. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you? Thanks so much for joining us.
It's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
Oh, investigative journalism.
Yes, that's right.
Where did I get justice? I must think, I must have been thinking about the Supreme Court.
Justices. It's an easy enough thing to do.
Yeah, got to get it right on this story. Can you tell me, how did this story come to you?
This is a collaborative reporting project between the Center for Investigative Journalism and Wisconsin Public Radio. One or the other of these news organizations became aware that there was an allegation that this had occurred, and we both worked to develop sources for it. Throughout the end of last week, talking to various people who were in a position to have authoritative information about this matter. And when we had enough sources that we were comfortable with reporting the story, we went ahead and reported it, which shook out some additional information, particularly later in the day on Saturday, after our first report was published.
Your report talks about three knowledgeable sources. Were those people who were in the room? Can you say who those sources were?
No, I can't tell you more about who they are, because we made agreements with all of our sources that we would not identify them. And if we start saying, you know, things about whether they were in the room or not, it's knowing that in the room were several members of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We had some indication that it was six of the seven justices, all of the justices except for Patrick Crooks, and that is also what the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported and attributed to one of its sources. The only source that has been on the record in terms of the substance of what occurred has been Justice Bradley, and she spoke only after this report aired, and then Justice Prosser issued what had was kind of a general denial that when all of the facts are known, the reports will be proven wrong. That's when she came forward with her comments to the Journal Sentinel about how you can spin this all you want, but this is what happened.
And indications are that the police were notified of this shortly after the event. The Capitol Police Chief is investigating this and will announce something sometime today.
He said he'd put out a statement of some kind or a press release of some kind today. He told that to your folks at Wisconsin Public Radio and also to at least one other media outlet which reported it as having come from him.
Do you know when we're going to receive that?
I don't. I have a call into his office right now trying to get more information about exactly when he intends to release this and whether there will be any, you know, opportunity for the media to ask questions.
Why would it be not a matter of course for the people who are in the room? Is there something different about Supreme Court justices that they wouldn't say, I was a witness to this, I'm going to get on the record, and here's what happened?
Well, I think, you know, people who are in the legal profession in general, and certainly Supreme Court justices, are people who have finely honed skills when it comes to keeping things confidential. That's a requirement of much of what they work on, is to not talk about certain things. I'm sure that in cases there are things that they don't share even with their spouses or other close people in their life. So I'm not surprised that an incident that happened apparently in full view of nearly all members of the court did not become public sooner than it did, although something like this does tend to want to get out one way or another. As people become aware of it, it does tend to seep out, and that's how we were able to trace it back to the to particular report about it.
Do you have any worries that the truth of this will never be known, or do you think that we will know, because as you well know, everybody's spinning this in a different way, that we will know exactly what happened?
I, as having been a reporter for 25 years, I have my concerns about whether you can use terms like truth to describe what you're likely to get out of a situation like this. My guess is that there will always be some element of profound dispute over the particulars of this matter. That seems to be the way it's sizing up now, and I guess no matter what comes out later, there'll be more information, certainly, but there'll always probably be division about what happened and what its components and characteristics were. I don't think you'll ever get to a point where everyone agrees, hey, this is exactly what happened, and this is what should be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too divisive an issue, and sides are already lining up on ideological grounds, which is, you know, I guess to be expected, but probably also unfortunate.
Yeah, it's definitely become ideological. But what hasn't these days? Everything's
right.
Pretty...
I guess that's a fair statement, yes.
The governor on Wisconsin Public Radio this morning was talking about the serious allegations, and later he was saying about serious allegations made by each of the justices in exposing a much larger problem that people on the court can't have civil, rational discourse. What's the background on this?
Well, this is not the first indication that there is a level of toxicity on the court that is, you know, clearly distressing. There was just a Wisconsin State Journal article a week or two ago about how the tensions on the court were obvious in the decision that was written on collective bargaining. And, of course, there's been these past incidents with, Justice Prosser did refer to the Chief Justice with a profane term and threatened to destroy her. And the Journal Sentinel reported additional information about that situation this weekend, talking about how Justice Bradley in particular had talked about how Prosser's flashes of extreme anger on and off over the years have been distressing to her, and that with regard to the outburst in which this profane language is used, that she had thought about contacting the police about this matter. I mean, that's, she said, it crossed my mind, but I didn't want to do it. I mean, that shows that this is not the first time that tensions have flared in really distressing and unhealthy ways.
Well, it is, when you think about it, a pretty shocking story, isn't it, for this story to come from the state Supreme Court?
Absolutely. And, you know, people want to, rest their case on one or another absolute interpretation. Did Justice Bradley charge at David Prosser with her fists in the air and he had to defend himself against this attacking woman? Or did he reach out and grab her by the neck in anger, as she's alleged? On some level, as the governor noted, no matter how that shakes out and whether that question is ever resolved, the fact that it came to a physical confrontation between two justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court indicates that something very unhealthy is in the dynamic there.
Yeah, very unhealthy. And if it is proven that there was a physical altercation, either she charging him and trying to hit him, or he takes her in a chokehold, aren't these kinds of criminal activities? Wouldn't taking somebody by the neck in a chokehold be an activity that might get you pretty seriously investigated? Can you continue being a justice?
Well, I'm going to leave that to prosecutors to decide once they have the information whether, you know, there's anything that would, you know, lead to any sort of sanction, whether it be a disorderly conduct citation or some more serious charge. I don't know that is something that can be profitably speculated on, because we just don't know to what extent there'll be clarity as to the interpretation of what occurred. And one thing that anyone who brings a charge wants to have on their side is clarity. You want to be able to say, yeah, if push comes to shove, I can get this testimony, which is clear, this testimony, which is clear, and these things are all clear and they're consistent. You know, as soon as accounts start to be at odds with each other, it makes it more difficult practically to pursue any sort of, you know, prosecution on any level.
Justice Prosser made mention of the anonymous claim made to the media that would be proven false. Some of the people who are concerned about this are concerned about anonymous claims. They want a name to all of this.
Sure.
How do you respond to that?
Well, we wanted a name for all of it, too, but we had to settle for having several sources, more than three, who were credible and reliable, who were representing what happened with clarity and consistency and seemed to be in a position to know. Having that, we went forward. There's been only one person who's been quoted on this, being Justice Bradley, and, you know, I have no reason to doubt the veracity of any of these individuals. Justice Prosser has not explicitly denied that he put his hands on her neck. He has not specifically alleged that she was the aggressor in the situation. That is where the information in the story is purely attributed to anonymous sources. The one or two people who the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel found who argued that what happened here was Bradley rushing at Prosser and him defending himself, that is purely based on anonymous sourcing. I don't know who those sources are. I have no way of gauging their credibility. In fact, I will ask right now on Wisconsin Public Radio if these sources would be willing to share their information with me. I'd like to talk to them. But we got no indication from anybody as we researched this story that there was this version of events that Bradley came at him or fists, you know, flying in the air, and that he reacted defensively, and there was some sort of incidental contact with her neck. That was something the Journal Sentinel found. I don't know where they found it. I don't know who their anonymous sources are. If people are concerned about anonymous sources, they should be. But this story has advanced beyond the point of anonymous sources now, because we've got a city member of the Wisconsin Supreme Court who says that she was grabbed aggressively around the neck by a colleague.
Yes. Would a paper need three anonymous sources from another point of view to say that is one anonymous source okay to go with that story?
Well, you know, you want to be able to present the story fairly and to give as full a picture as you can. We didn't have the benefit of anyone offering this alternative version of events when we did our initial report. Our initial report shook loose that, and it shook loose David Prosser's statement that he released when he had the opportunity to talk to us. He just absolutely declined to say anything about it. I don't know where that information comes from or how solid it is. What I do know is that our information was very solid and that we were very confident in representing this story on the level of allegation. Now, we didn't say that David Prosser grabbed anyone by the throat. We said he allegedly did. We were reporting an allegation, and an allegation of conduct of this sort is news on the level of allegation. We recognize that, and I feel that Justice Bradley's comments subsequent to this to the Journal Sentinel affirmed that this allegation is indeed out there. That story, that part, that our story was affirmed to that extent.
It's,
I want to say one other thing about this. This isn't the first time that I had a chance to work with Wisconsin Public Radio on this. I was tremendously impressed with the professionalism and the skill of the people at Wisconsin Public Radio. This was something that was a team effort. There were a number of reporters who worked this very hard. I don't think I'm giving away something too much if I tell people that we had a All the President's Men moment on this story, where the heads of our respective organizations, the Center for Investigative Journalism and Wisconsin Public Radio, were assessing what it is we had and basically told the team of reporters, we need more.
Right.
And we went out and we got more before we went with the story that we ran.
Yeah, it's an important story. You have to make sure you got the story. One more question before we take a couple phone calls. I find it significant that six of the seven justices were in the room. Were there other people in the room? Do you know?
I am not in a position to say that. I have some indication, but I don't feel it's solid enough for me to say.
Okay. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, good morning. I don't really share the accolades of WPR. This morning, Joy Cardine asked the governor if he somehow felt responsible for this. It's an allegation. We don't know what happened, and yet Joy seemed to be trying to see if the governor is going to accept some sort of responsibility for this. And if you look at the way the police have handled things in Madison, they've arrested people. There's no fines being given out. Have we heard what's happened to Catherine Wendells, who sent the emails, threatening Governor Walker? Why is none of that exposed as possibly raising the level of confrontation in Madison? And the police seem in concert with it, they took a woman out in handcuffs.
Yeah, well, let's talk about
later.
John. Let's talk about the matter at hand here. What information? Wait a second. What information do you want to know? What remains in question?
I want to know why it took. This was over a month ago. If she filed a claim with the police, why wasn't that immediately made public?
Okay.
Well, first of all, it wasn't over a month ago. The best information to date is that happened on Monday, June 13th. Our story said it happened just prior to the release of the collective bargaining decision. We weren't sure if it was that Monday the 13th or Tuesday the 14th. The Journal Sentinel found a source that said it was late in the day on the 13th. So it was reported a little less than 2 weeks after it happened, not more than a month ago. And I don't know what else I can respond to about that.
If it was reported to the police right away, why wasn't it a story? Why didn't the police? Why didn't somebody come forward and?
Because police don't generally announce to the world that they're working on a sensitive investigation involving, Supreme Court justices. I think it has been solidly confirmed that this information was called to the attention of the Capitol Police, and also that Chief Charles did meet with members of the court to discuss the matter. We hope to learn more about that, but the question of why didn't he make an announcement to the world earlier about this is a question that should be put to him. Obviously, we would have liked that if he had given us additional information about it when we repeatedly contacted him and asked him to do so.
Thanks, John. Willem from Colfax. Hi.
Hi. I was just saying, reading in the paper that there's a chapter 60 of the Supreme Court rules and the official judicial code of conduct states that that the justices need to be civil in their dealings with one another and to abstain from any conduct that may be characterized as uncivil, abrasive, abusive, hostile or obstructive. I think that he's already violated that, but when he called the Chief Justice what he called and said he was going to destroy her, plus I think this sort of reflects on his nature. I heard him speak on the Wisconsin Public Radio interview before the last Supreme Court election, and he said he hadn't formed an opinion on this collective bargaining rule. I think that's clearly not the case. And then he said that when he won the recall, or when he won the election, that they withstood a nuclear blast, which I thought was a very poor choice of words. And then he also stated that that his winning this election that was within the close enough to cause an automatic recall, a recount, that he said it was a mandate for conservative principles. So I think that in more ways than one, I'm not surprised that this allegation has occurred, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was found to be true. And if it is found to be true, I think he should be removed from office.
Okay, Willem, thank you very much for the call. Bill, where are you going from here with the story? What are you doing today?
Well, we'll try to see what the Capitol Police have to say. We'll try to see if we can get more information about what, if anything, the Judicial Commission is doing in terms of looking into this. There is a clause in their rules that if a case becomes public, they are able to give some limited information about it. This case has definitely become public. And we'll see if other things emerge, you know, from other avenues and sources.
Thank you, Bill, so much for being with us. We really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. And we'll follow through, and I'm sure other programs will as well. Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. They, along with Wisconsin Public Radio, broke the story over the weekend, which is a continuing saga, allegations that Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice David Prosser grabbed fellow Justice Ann Walsh Bradley around the neck in an argument in her chambers last week, an event that was witnessed by 6 of the 7 Supreme Court justices. We are continuing all things political. We're just completely changing topics. Bill Schneider will be joining us momentarily. Bill is a leading U.S. political analyst and expert on public opinion research, a distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at the Third Way, and a professor of public policy at George Mason University in Washington. He has been CNN's senior political analyst since 1990, is also a contributing editor to the National Journal and the Atlantic Monthly, and he is a member of the CNN political team that was awarded an Emmy for its 2006 election coverage and a Peabody for the 2008 election coverage. So we go to Bill in just a moment and welcome your phone calls on National All Things Political at 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Schneider with us now as we examine national news and international news as well. He has joined us before on this program, and we welcome him again. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.
Yeah. You wrote an interesting piece. Let's talk about jobs. We don't spend enough time on jobs. You wrote a piece that appeared in Politico. The latest unemployment figures convey a powerful warning. What's the warning, Bill?
The warning is that if something doesn't turn around, President Obama is in serious, serious trouble. We've never elected, at least since Roosevelt in the 1930s, we have never elected, or rather re-elected, a president when the unemployment rate is over 7%. It's now over 9%, and economists don't expect it to get below 8% next year, even if things go pretty well, which means he's facing a very tough re-election campaign.
So what is he to do about this? He's been told for a long time by many economists that something needs to be done to stimulate jobs. I think he's tried one program that perhaps wasn't very successful. Do we need a major government jobs proposal? What do we need? What does he need to do?
Well, there's a whole debate about that. There was an economic stimulus bill. A lot of people don't believe it because they don't think it had much impact. Economists say it did have an impact, and it saved us from what could have been a very bad depression even. But it isn't really felt by the American people because it wasn't that dramatic. And it's very unlikely now that the House is controlled by Republicans and there are a lot more Republicans in the Senate that any significant new spending program is likely to come out of government. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens is going to depend mostly on the private sector. Even the Federal Reserve, which is a government agency, says there's not much more it can do. You know, there's this myth in the United States that the president is commander-in-chief of the economy. He's not. People treat him as if he were. He can just tell gas prices to go down and jobs to go up. But he can't do that. Nobody can. This is a $13 trillion economy, and it's not controlled or commanded by anybody.
Our attention seems to be focused on August 2nd, as you remind us, the latest possible date for raising the debt ceiling without endangering the good faith and credit of the United States. You also write that most Americans see the deficit the same way they've seen it for the past 30 years, serious, but not an immediate crisis. Why is this the focal point of our attention?
Because of the law, which says that if Congress, this is the only country that does that, if Congress does not increase the debt ceiling, the amount we can borrow, then there's a risk that the United States will be seen as a bad debtor and that the full faith and credit of the United States will suddenly be put at risk. It could happen that bondholders will panic, people will flee from American Treasury bills, and it could shake the foundations of not just the American economy, but the world economy. There are all kinds of dire warnings. None of them may come true. When you ask Americans, polls have been doing this, how serious do they consider this problem, they sort of shrug it off and they say this is a problem of Washington's own creation. The real problem to Americans is jobs, the economy, gas prices. The debt ceiling strikes them as something happening in Washington, far away.
Mm-hmm. And we continue debate about whether or not we're going to increase taxes. Are we going to cut programs? Do we need sort of a cross-the-board examination of all this, that taxes have to be on the table, that the debt also has to be on the table for future generations in addition to jobs?
Yes, there is that debate right now. And the question is, should everything be on the table? A lot of Republicans are saying, no. We want to take taxes off the table. We can't consider revenue increases. Democrats insist we have to consider at least raising taxes on the very wealthy in this country, ending some tax breaks that are no longer useful. Republicans just won't talk about that. They insist that certain things like spending cuts are necessary. Other things really can't be discussed. And some leading Republicans from Congress literally walked out of the meetings with Vice President Biden last week because they refused to talk about taxes and Democrats refused to rule them out. Well, there's a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel because for the first time in many years, House Republicans say they're willing to think about defense spending cuts, something that has been forbidden since at least Ronald Reagan. And so there might be some possibility of making a deal to cut both domestic and defense spending and get through the debt ceiling problem.
What did you think of the president's speech on Afghanistan?
I thought he was trying to do what he said. Namely, he wanted a centrist course in foreign policy, and he tried to define a new way of carrying out foreign policy that was less unilateral, less dependent on the use of force than it was under President Bush. And the result was he didn't really make anyone happy. He angered a lot of Democrats who want to get out of Afghanistan much more quickly. And a lot of Republicans who are losing patience with Afghanistan, they now believe it's Obama's war since he supported a surge in 2009. They don't think it's going particularly well. And it is very, very expensive. We are spending over $300 million a day in Afghanistan. A lot of members of Congress and a lot of people out there in the electorate say, we can't afford it.
Well, and they're also asking, what are we getting for it, huh?
What are we getting for it, did you say?
Yeah, what are we getting for it, for that $300
million? Well, supposedly, we're getting more security that Afghanistan is moving towards something that may be democracy. We can't be sure that it is no longer providing a base for the Taliban. I think the original justification for the intervention in Afghanistan in 1991 was that they were harboring terrorists who had attacked the United States. We overthrew the Taliban regime, but the Taliban is still there. They have roots in Afghanistan, ethnic roots. You can't simply expel them. They're Afghans. They have to participate somehow in government, and we're hoping that we can create a government that incorporates them without allowing them to create a regime that harbors terrorists. But to most Americans, they say, we can't build a nation in Afghanistan. We don't understand it. It's too far away. And most of all, it's an enormous waste of lives and money to do that.
Yeah. Let's go back to the economy in the U.S. You also wrote in that before mentioned political piece about the number of, and there's not a lot written about this, state and local governments shedding jobs at an alarming rate. 28,000 public sector jobs were cut in May. Are we going to see more of that?
Unfortunately, I think the answer is yes. And this is happening in states controlled by Republicans, like Wisconsin, and those controlled at least mostly by Democrats, like New York. Governor Cuomo has cut a lot of jobs there. The money just isn't there. The economy is slow. The revenues are not coming in. Some of the jobs that have been eliminated were redundant and probably not necessary, but a lot of them are very important jobs, providing for the welfare and security of a lot of lower-income Americans, teachers, policemen, firemen, prison guards. A lot of those jobs are simply gone, and it's hurting Americans very, very deeply. And the private sector so far has not been able to create enough jobs really to make up that difference.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about New York for a moment. Quite a political feat to get gay marriage passed in that city. I guess they're still celebrating now. What, do you want to analyze that for us, how it happened and the impact on the rest of the country?
Well, it is a very dramatic move. I mean, it more than doubles the number of Americans who live in states where same-sex couples can marry. New York is a key state. That's where the gay rights movement began 42 years ago. It's really a tribute to Governor Cuomo. I mean, he was persistent. Remember, this was passed by a Republican-controlled state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Republican-controlled state
Senate.
Just a couple of years ago, the Democratic-controlled legislature rejected same-sex marriage. And now it's gotten through. Cuomo twisted arms. He was very effective. I think he's become a star in the Democratic Party. He also got a lot of budget measures through, mostly because he persuaded unions to go along with the cuts. He made deals with them. And one of the main reasons is they trust him. He's a Democrat. His name is Cuomo. He chose not to confront the unions the way it's being done in other states. It also happened because polls show that more and more Americans, rapid change, one of the fastest changes in public opinion I've ever seen in my lifetime, more and more Americans support the same right of same-sex couples to marry, and the gay rights movement became organized and focused and really put pressure on that legislature.
Yeah. From the Times piece yesterday, it sounds like he really had a firm hand on how all of this was handled, and heavens knows those the apple didn't fall too far from the tree when it came to being a Cuomo, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, his name had a lot to do with it, his father's reputation. And a lot of people are looking at him and saying, you know, he's a real contender for 2016 when the Democratic nomination will open up again.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Our number, Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'd like to tie in the Confederate flag Easter story and the relevance of religion to the world.
Okay.
And every so often, the Confederate flag, something comes up in the South where they honor the Confederate veterans on the basis that they fought and died for something that they believed in, which raises the question, why do we automatically honor people who die in wars if the war that they died for was stupid in the first place, especially if it involves not relating religion to life. In the Easter story, Jesus was scourged, and the whipping that he received was by the Romans was not judged to be okay in terms of religious principles. But in terms of slavery in the Confederacy, it was okay to exploit black people for their labor, okay to whip them and rape their women, even in spite of the fact that the Bible says that we ought to love our neighbor as ourselves. So the question is, why did they support this in slavery? And the larger question is that if people can't relate religious principles to what's going on in the world, well, why go to church in the first place if you're not going to support what your religion preaches?
Bill.
Well, that's a very complex question. Religion certainly plays more of a role in politics since really Ronald Reagan than it ever has in the past. And one of the problems, of course, is that religious beliefs often conflict. Before the Civil War, the issue of slavery split religious denominations. You had Southern Baptists and Northern Baptists. The entire country bitterly divided over religion. He asked about honoring the Confederate dead. I think you have to be careful. You may honor, or people feel that you should honor, those who sacrificed their lives for a cause they believed in as martyrs, as people who made a contribution. But there's a difference between doing that and believing in that cause. The South fought the Civil War to protect and preserve slavery. There's no question about it. I grew up in the South, and there was an attempt to cover over that fact. When I was in school, that it was fought for states' rights or something else, low tariffs. It was fought for to preserve slavery. That's a cause that very few Americans anymore can imagine believing in, but at one time in this country, it was a very serious cause. It's a difference between honoring those who devoted their life to a principle and honoring that principle.
Where did you grow up, Bill?
In Southern Virginia, segregated schools.
Hmm.
And I witnessed a dramatic revolution, one of the great moral revolutions in history. We transformed an entire culture and society with some violence. Certainly, a lot of people died. But it happened quite rapidly, and it was a very impressive transformation.
Thanks, Jim, for your always interesting calls. Jess in Milwaukee, hi.
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 Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Regarding the Obama presidency and serious trouble over the economy, could Obama execute or could he use the executive order to require a tax increase on the super rich, which economist Paul Krugman felt would be really worthwhile?
No, he could not do that. Without declaring emergency powers, which the Constitution does not give him, no, the power over the purse is given to Congress, particularly to the House of Representatives, where revenue bills must originate. That's why the president is in something of a bind, because Republicans control the House, and they will not countenance, they say, any kind of tax increase. They may make some deals involving ending some tax breaks and some programs they feel are no longer necessary, but that's going to be very tough. No, the president cannot do it on his own. We have a separation of powers in this country.
All right.
Thanks, Jess. Thanks for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political, and Bill Schneider is our guest this part of the program, leading U.S. political analyst. He has been CNN's senior political analyst since 1990, is a contributing editor to the National Journal, the Atlantic Monthly, distinguished senior fellow and resident scholar at Third Way, and professor of public policy at George Mason University. Two more of your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls for Bill. Doug in Pell Lake. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Kathleen. I think it's somewhat ironic that for the here we have a country beset by a multiplicity of problems, both domestic and foreign, and we have at its helm a fellow that's never managed anything, and really never has had the ability, has had any experience in prioritizing anything, and so it's really ironic, but it's also a warning, because I personally believe this lack of prioritization, which you saw with Obamacare, he spent the first year trying to pass an ideology when he should have been focused on getting the economy back on all fours. It's actually a warning to all Republican and Democrat politicos that we absolutely need people in this government that know how to manage and prioritize things and have a track record. Ironically, Herman Cain and the Republican side, because you see all these characters that are running on the Republican side that have never managed anything to save their lives, have a track record and effectively nothing from a business standpoint. The only guy is Cain, who actually has actually turned around things. A black American who probably at the end of the day is going to be seen as the person necessary to lead this country. That's my comment. Be interested to hear what Snyder thinks.
All right, Doug. Thanks. Thanks for the call.
Well, I would disagree only to this extent. Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney claims, and this claim will be debated during the campaign, that he's been a successful manager. He certainly turned around the Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City in 2002, he was governor of Massachusetts. He passed the health care bill, which a lot of Republicans think was outrageous, but he claims it was right for Massachusetts. He claims he turned around a lot of companies as the leader of a major investment firm. He created jobs. Some of those jobs went to China, and he also shut down some companies and lost some jobs. But he at least claims this is how he's running for president, and right now he's the narrow front runner. He claims that he has experience as a manager, that he's been a business person. Do you know how many business executives have ever been elected president of the United States?
Not many.
The answer is two.
Two?
Both named Bush. You don't normally elect business executives to be president. Well, Romney thinks this is a time when exactly what the caller was asking about, management skills, experience, that kind of competence, which really Barack Obama does not have. He's never been a business person. That's something that can sell in the election next year, and Romney's running very hard on that, as well as Herman Cain.
Mm-hmm. Michelle Bachmann doing well in Iowa, is that meaningless? Does that mean something?
It means that she's likely to be a serious contender for the nomination. She could win Iowa. If she does, I think Tim Pawlenty will probably begin to fade as a serious candidate. They're both from Minnesota, which is next door to Iowa. If she wins Iowa, it'll be a very dramatic breakthrough for her. She's already being taken seriously as a result of her performance in the debate. My guess is, in the end, there's going to be one establishment candidate. It looks like Romney right now, although John Huntsman could be the guy. It's not entirely clear what issue he's running on. And there'll be someone who isn't the anti- or un-Romney candidate, and that could very well be Michelle Bachmann. And we're going to see a real fight in the Republican Party between those two wings of the party.
Yeah, don't they have to get together somehow, or the Democrats are going to squeeze through?
Yes, that happens every time there are primaries. Remember Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
Mm-hmm.
They got together. She's the Secretary of State. She supported him. But there was a very bitter fight until the very end in 2008.
We go to Mike in Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, I have two questions. Do you think Christie will jump in at the end? And if he does, is it a game changer? And then I'm a small business person, and I'd like to ask you, from the perspective of a small business person, do you think that that sense of uncertainty, which I feel with this current administration, with regards to so many different things, is being a break to the creation of jobs?
That was a very interesting comment, and that is what a lot of business people are saying right now. The biggest problem that the government presents is uncertainty, uncertainty about the debt ceiling, uncertainty about government spending, uncertainty about the future of the economy, uncertainty about what in the world government can do to really guide, much less control, the nation's economy. No one knows what's coming down the pike. Are we headed for another recession or even a depression? Is the economy suddenly going to start to improve the way it did in the 1990s with the dot-com boom? That uncertainty is really the main reason why it is very difficult for businesses to hire people and create jobs. And until that's resolved, it's going to continue to be difficult. The caller asked also about the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who's been a very confrontational governor. A lot of people are pressuring him to run. They think he could be the salvation of the Republican Party. He is a real populist. I mean, he really mixes it up with people. You can see Christie's confrontations on YouTube all the time. He says what he thinks. He's very direct. In many ways, he is the opposite of Barack Obama. He was not a business person, but he was a successful prosecutor in New Jersey, where he put a lot of people behind bars. He knows how to get things done and has management skills. And there's pressure on him to get into the race. He insists he's not running. He's only been governor of New Jersey for a couple of years, that this is not the year for him. He's not ready for it. He may stick to that. But believe me, a lot of people in the Republican establishment with a lot of money are really hoping he'll jump into the race. I don't know that the prospects are particularly good that he will, but the money is there.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. Phil in Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. I just have a quick one for you. I caught the Chris Matthews morning show Sunday morning yesterday, and at the end of his show he does a segment called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And I don't know which guest it was, but the guest said to him, there's another stimulus package we worked on by the administration. Be tasked because there has to be, and it's going to happen this year. Do you think that's even a possibility?
Remote, but if the economy suddenly takes a nosedive, if unemployment shoots up and the electorate says, do something because we're angry and we're desperate, I think the pressure will be felt by both the president and Congress to do something. And that could involve another round. It'll be a temporary round, but another sharp and clear round of stimulus spending to get the economy back on its feet. That could happen, but I think it'll only happen if the economy takes a sudden turn for the worse.
I'm having a hard time figuring out what's going on with the economy, because it wasn't a couple months ago or 3 months ago that we were seeing news reports. Things are doing better. People are hiring more. You had these signs of hope. And then 2 months later, it's, are we entering another severe recession? Everything's on the wrong track. What's going on?
Well, the same thing that happened last year. The early part of the year, things were looking good in 2010, and then suddenly in the spring, things started going downhill, and the economy looked like it was unraveling. Then it picked up again early 2011, and now, beginning with the rise in gasoline prices, which the United States government does not control, that's a world market, when gas prices shot up in April and May, suddenly things went into a tailspin, and especially with the uncertainty over what's happening around the world, China, the debt crisis in Europe, the stock market began to fall, and things began to unravel again. It's a very, very unsteady, uncertain recovery, and it's the main reason, I repeat, why it's very difficult for employers to hire people, because they don't know what's coming down the road. They don't know if demand will be there, if people will start buying again. And until they feel reassured about that, which is one thing the government can try to do, that you know things are looking up, we see a light at the end of the tunnel, if they believe that there's a greater certainty of recovery, then they'll begin hiring, but not until then.
Gas prices have gone down quite a bit the last couple of weeks. What's that all about?
Well, they have been going down. The world market does fluctuate, and a lot of people were surprised to see that President Obama released some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. That looked like a purely political move, you know, to keep gas prices low. But at a time when they're going down, why did he do that? It's only happened a couple of times in the past during real crises. Well, he argued it's because of Libya, because Libya controls a small but important percentage of the world's oil reserves, and if those go off the market, something has to be done to replace them. But here in Washington, that surprised everyone and was seen as a really political move.
Gary in Wausau, hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
I have a couple of questions. One on the interest rate that we are paying for our debt in this nation. I believe it's something like $413 billion and such. I guess, who are we actually paying this to in? Can we not just stop paying that and start all over again or whatever? Maybe that's very stupid to say that. And I have one other question about how much money we are actually spending abroad in protecting and bringing up countries to democracy and actually protecting our own selves here. Could we not just spend that money here on our own borders for maybe better technology, enhancing our technology, and protecting our own borders here, as well as maybe all planes that do come in from overseas, could actually just have a few landing zones and check people out that way?
Well, you asked about the interest rate. It's very low right now, but there is a threat of default. That's what the debt ceiling debate is all about. It's a very big unknown, a very great uncertainty there. And the question is, what would happen if the United States suddenly said, we're not going to borrow any more money to finance government spending? Would bondholders panic? Would they lose faith in the United States Treasury certificates? We don't know what would happen. It is an enormous unknown. It's never happened before. Most Americans don't see it as a real crisis. They think it was concocted on Wall Street and in Washington, but it is an unknown, and a lot of people are very fearful of what's going to happen. Until that's resolved, I think the economy is unlikely to start taking off. Spending abroad, of course, most Americans overwhelmingly believe that that money could be much better spent protecting our borders, protecting Americans, that what we're doing in places like Libya and Afghanistan is really not doing that much to protect the security of the United States. The problem is, you know, we don't want walls. Some people do, but certainly in the southern border. But it's hard to put up walls that are impregnable around the United States. People will come in boats. They'll come in airplanes. They'll come some other way. We don't want to become a garrison state. That's very, very unlikely to work. We have to do something to control the problem of illegal immigration, and then we have to figure out what to do with the illegal immigrants who are already here. It's a very serious problem. I'm not sure throwing money at it will make an enormous amount of difference, but it could help.
Thanks, Gary. We have about a minute left. Jeff in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. Real short question. In December, we extended the tax breaks for the rich. The Republicans said it was necessary to create jobs. So I'm asking, where are the jobs? And I'm wondering why the rest of America is saying, where are the jobs?
The rest of America is saying, where are the jobs? That's what the tax cuts were all about. They were extended from the Bush period. And we don't see them. At first, it looked like things were doing pretty well. Right after the tax cuts were extended in the early part of the year, the economy looked like it was poised to expand. But there's always, not always, but unfortunately, there is often something that goes wrong. In this case, I think it was uncertainty about the national debt. It was uncertainty about what government would do, and it was the sudden spike in gas prices, which has dropped a good deal since then, but still very high historically. There's just so much uncertainty in this country that the jobs, as I say, employers are unwilling to bet that the economy is going to expand and then start hiring people because they feel that will happen.
And thank you very much for the call, Jeff. Bill, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure to be with you.
Bill Schneider, leading U.S. political analyst. He has been working for CNN as their senior political analyst since 1990, received an Emmy, also a Peabody for election coverage in 2006 and also in 2008. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios for all of your phone calls. As always, many thanks. We will continue with more of our Monday conversation. A real interesting conversation coming up, so stay with us. That's coming up right after the latest news. Which you'll hear momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.